Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Art, a podcast channel on the New Book Network. I'm your host today, Kaveh Rafii, a PhD candidate in art history at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Today, I'm speaking with Professor Nicholas Brown about his monograph, Autonomy, the Social Ontology of Art Under Capitalism, which came about in 2019 by the Duke University Press. Professor Brown teaches modernism, African literature, and critical theory in the English department and in the Department of African American Studies with an affiliate position in art history at the University of Illinois at Chicago. His research interests include Marxism, Hegel studies, the history of aesthetics, Lusophone literature, and music studies. His first monograph, Utopian Generations, The Political Horizon of 20th Century Literature, published by the Princeton Press in 2005, examined the relationship between postcolonial literature and European modernism and the relationship of each to the continuing crises in global economic system. Former president of Marxist Literary Group, Professor Brown chairs the editorial board of the journal Mediations, and is a founding editor of the electronic and print press MCM. Hi, Nick, and welcome to New Books in Art.
Glad to be here.
Yeah. Let's dive in right in and talk about your book, Autonomy, which offers a fresh perspective on aesthetic autonomy and its political value, one of the great debate, perhaps, of the 20th century. The book illustrates the viability of a modernist project in the era after postmodernism while offering one illuminating reading after another of the contemporary examples. The first time I read the book, I was blown away by how many examples were found in novels, photography, sculpture, popular music, TV, and movies. Definitely has a vigor of old-fashioned art criticism, which I am fond of. Reading each example was very enlightening for me, actually. That is to say, an outstanding work, and thank you for that. To begin with, you tell us about the story behind this book. How did it came about?
Yeah, sure. I will do that. I'll say a couple other things, though, just in response to your introduction to the book. You know, I mean, one is, and this is probably going to come up in the conversation, is that the argument or discussion about the autonomy of art, it is obviously a 20th century issue, but it goes way back farther than that. And in fact, you know, this was sort of at issue through much of the debates throughout the 19th century, throughout Europe. The question of, and I really appreciate your pointing out that the work, you know, although it has a theoretical point, I hope, you know, really functions through the examples, because the whole point, as I take it, of the concept of art as it develops in the late 18th century, is that it produces a kind of instance where a certain kind of thinking is possible, and that certain kind of thinking is thinking through concrete situations where abstract thinking although it might be at work, can't produce the kind of convincing kind of account of the situation. And I think that's what art has in common with Hegel, his Phenomenology of Spirit. It's just like example, that's all it is. It's like example after example. So the book is deliberately example after example. Art is dealing with the problem of posed for them by the market, and then they have to work through it themselves. So you can't produce any sort of a priori answers of how does art deal with the market. You can only look at examples, and that's why the book is all those examples. So, you know, in a way that answers your first question, I just had a sense that was more or less the new millennium, but, you know, more or less the new century, there was something afoot. There was a kind of you know, I came up doing graduate school in the 90s, the sort of sense of the market as the ultimate horizon of the work of art being something sort of, you know, either shrugged at or humped at or depressively moped at or enthused about was nonetheless accepted. And I got a sense that in the arts, that sort of stopped being the case, you know, not abruptly at 2000, but, you know, something around then, a sense that this was not a satisfactory account of what art was doing. And I wanted to turn to some instances where I thought that was really visible.
Yeah. Thank you. I was thinking about the introduction. The introduction opens up with this challenging question by George Lukács, quoting, "Work of art exist. How are they possible?" So you explore the notion of art's autonomy in order to answer this question. What is the autonomy of art, and why is fundamental to the existence of art as a category under the capitalism, specifically market?
Yeah, so I mean, to answer that, I'm going to maybe go back a while. I don't know how extensive my answer should be, but I'll say, you know, first of all, you know, autonomy has many sort of connotations, and I sort of struggled a bit, not with myself. I always thought this is what the book was going to be called. Many people wanted me not to call the book Autonomy, since it had sort of a ring of sort of older philosophical or older theoretical debates. But it really is about autonomy. About autonomy, first of all, in just the literal sense of being selfless. So the idea behind, on my view, the only coherent account of art, although there are lots of different versions of it, is a self-legislating object. What makes it different than other kinds of objects? And I'll explain what I mean by that. So just literally autonomous. Now the question is, you know, what are the threats to that autonomy? And leaping forward to our own time, you know, to me, or to my, on my view rather, you know, the dominant threat to the autonomy of the work of art, to the self-legislating legislating nature of the work of art, is the market. But Kava, do you want to leap in with another question, or should I explain what I mean by what I just said?
Yeah, maybe we can dig more. One thing that very much stands out to me, there is also in a great sense these influences of late 18th century, 19th century aesthetic, specifically about autonomy, coming back from Immanuel Kant and Hegel, and very much you can see around this autonomy the idea of purposefulness without purpose, and these ideas is came frequently in the book. Maybe we can, you know, save more focus about these concepts and move on.
Yeah. So, Kaveh, as you know well, you know, Kant's conception of aesthetic judgment centers around that idea of purposiveness without purpose. And as you also know well, the whole purpose of that formulation, the whole purpose of that formulation is to separate it out from other kinds of judgment, the judgment of the pleasant or the agreeable, and the judgment of the good. The judgment of the pleasant occurs according to just your body or my body, things we like. In that sense, it's not an autonomous judgment. My body decides that I like sugar I like sweet chocolate, and it just does. I don't have any choice about that. The judgment of the good, on the other hand, proceeds according to concepts. You know, if someone says that's a right triangle, it is sort of either it is or it isn't. You know, I measure the angles, and if it's a right triangle, it's a right triangle. And I have, you know, again, it's also not an autonomous judgment. But the judgment of the beautiful in Kant is something like what my son, he's always referring to things as being satisfying, which in his, I think it's his generation, but his sort of language means something that's just somehow, you know, you think it's somehow right. That door closes right. This shape is right. This handle fits right, and so on and so forth. So it's a sort of sense of rightness. But for Kant, where that autonomy comes from, it's a special kind of judgment because it's a special kind of something special is happening in your brain. To put it vulgarly, it's more complicated than that, again, as you know. But in Hegel, in his lectures on fine art, he makes it sound as though he's, just adopting Kant's standpoint wholesale, which is unusual because he usually is not very nice to Kant. But in the situation he is, but in fact, he's not accepting it wholesale. He converts purposiveness without purpose, which is something that exists in the mind, it's a certain kind of judgment, to purposiveness without external purpose, in other words, a certain kind of object. So a certain kind of object whose purpose is legislated by the thing itself. In other words, a thing where you don't know what it is or what it's trying to do until it tells you itself what it is and what it's trying to do. So its norms are sort of encoded somehow in the object itself. And again, to me, that's what makes that is a convincing account of what makes the work of art different than all kinds of other culture that we have. Food is complicated and pleasant. Mugs. I'm just looking around, looking at random things. Furniture design. All these things are more or less aesthetic. But that's what distinguishes an aesthetics from a philosophy of fine art. That's why it's called Lectures on Fine Art, not the aesthetics as we casually call it in English, because Hegel is really concerned to produce a certain kind of object. And I think it's a compelling account. I think it's with all its variations, not only the only compelling account, but also the one that undergirds just the way we deal with works of art when we deal with them as they're meant to be dealt with. Anyway, it's our naive conception. We may not have it in mind all the time. In fact, we don't. But it underlies the kinds of things we do with art when we talk to each other and say, what do you think that meant? A friend of mine or my father and I actually having an argument about Tar, the movie. The question is not like, was it pleasant or not? The question is like, why did that happen? And only the movie can tell you why. The only sort of convincing account of why if you've seen the movie, the young women are arranged like an orchestra in the last scenes, only the movie can tell you. It's not something that can be found elsewhere.
Yeah, I see. This is fascinating, specifically how Hegel twists this logic, and also. As you develop this idea in relation to the commodity form, it's fascinating. Maybe we can come back to this. I'm really interested in unpacking more about this meaningfulness in relationship to commodity. But maybe before doing that, maybe I want to ask also, since you brought up this. Also, the importance of examples, and as you're working through in each chapter, it's fascinating. Like you're moving between the different mediums, and this and making this thread is very much fascinating. I'm curious about very much how the argument crosses these different mediums and forms, and in each chapter, this. Art medium or types very much prominent. One becomes very much prominent, and I'm curious if any specific you already mentioned a specific reason, but maybe putting together as a chapters and the whole narration of book, why they are so and why this organized this way.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm gonna. Actually, touch on your suggested later question as a way of getting to that. We may come back to this, but that conception of art as something whose meaning can only be established by sort of protocols established by the work itself comes under threat in various ways at various times. the signal instance, maybe the first sort of major one, is in France, 1848, which, you know, eventually produces what we think of as modernism, or at least the great flowering of the new art in France in the second half of the 19th century. But mostly understood as, or I understand it anyway, as a sudden understanding, not exactly of the market yet, but of audience and of class, and therefore of market, as being a threat. In other words, what is being written is not being written for some kind of a featureless subject, but rather being written for, in context, the bourgeoisie, and that's a problem. So now suddenly this has to be sort of addressed. So on my account, for us, you know, late 20th century, early 21st century people, that instance, that threat is the market. Because, of course, if something is produced for the market, what it's produced for is to make a profit, is to sell. It's for exchange. And whether something is exchangeable or not is not something that that I or you as sellers decide, something that the buyer decides. And then sort of the problem of making things for the market emerges as a problem. Again, turning back to my own graduate school experience, I just remember it was like the nail in the coffin argument. If you want to take a work of art seriously, someone would just mention what market is meant for. Right? Oh, you know, that's just for white men nostalgic for modernism. That's just, you know, but name your demographic. It could be any demographic. And then that sort of puts an end to the idea of taking it seriously. And in a way, that's right. So, you know, works of art have to like address that issue. In other words, if they want to be taken seriously, they have to somehow produce the own plausibility, the plausibility of the market not being the determining instance. So that's what the book is about. But all of these markets, all of these audiences for our works look different. The audience for the novel and the way the novel interacts with an audience or a market is different from pop music, very different than pop music. In fact, television is different and art photography relatively insulated from that dynamic. And Hollywood film, of course, in a very different way, interacts with that dynamic. So the major chapters are, there's one in the novel, there's one on pop music, there's one on television, and there's one sort of divided between art photography and Hollywood film. And again, what organizes those is the different relations to the market. But again, since part of my point is there can't be anything a priori said about those relations, you sort of have to work through it. And in working through it, you find that there may not be rules, but there are sort of commonalities. And so each of those chapters that's in a major way about one of those art forms is also about another art form where the particular instance has a family resemblance to something, some other art form. In this case, more novel, but also contemporary sculpture, theater, particularly Brecht, and art film in the figure of Jürgen Leth. And there are many, many more sort of smaller instances sprinkled throughout. Does that start to answer your question?
Yeah. I think that's actually beautifully worked out, but both, I think, very much connected to both questions connected together and beautifully linked together. Thank you. So perhaps this question is a follow-up about, you put an interesting spin on, you know, modernist idea about autonomy. Usually, as we understand, for modernism, in more classical view of autonomy, it has to do with medium or forms. But you write here, the originality of the present moment is that the concept of medium or material support must be expanded to include the commodity character of the work, unquote. Thus, the proposed account of autonomy doesn't stop at the forms and medium specificity, but also examines what you call a framing procedure. You already touched on these issues, I think, in your answer, but maybe you can, you know, unpack a bit more for the audience.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, there are two ways you can think about it, and neither one is more right than the other. You can think of it as going beyond medium specificity, or you can think of it as expanding medium specificity to include the relationship of each medium to the market. Either it describes the same thing in different languages, but here's where again, something you know very well, but is where the importance of Michael Fried's work comes in. Because of course, or maybe not of course, but we don't tend to think of it. You tend to look at a work of art, and you already zero out thousands and thousands of arbitrary determinants, right? Why do we have even easel art? There's a theory to that, or not easel art, but even wall art. Easel art has its own history. The fact that things are framed, blah, blah, blah. All these things have a history, and history is by nature, contingent and arbitrary. And so, whenever we look at a work of art, in some sense, that would be my version of modernism, but it's not by any means only mine, is when that problem of taking, when the medium can no longer be taken for granted, the historical contingency of it appears as a problem and therefore has to be made in a certain sense to disappear. Of course, it doesn't really disappear, right? It's always there, but has to be sort of be addressed in order not to seem the determining instance. So that's the sort of, the Friedian, partly the Friedian line. And my purpose in the book was to take that, and include, the relationship to the market, which again is just in a certain sense, just like the historicity of, something like easel art. It has a contingent history. It doesn't in a certain sense matter, for what the work of art is, but as soon as that, becomes a problem, as soon as our understanding of the work of art involves an understanding of, oh, this is written for a market, and that makes a difference, then that difference has to be defeated or overcome in order for the meaning to sort of to be plausible, to stick, right, or to have a chance of sticking.
Yeah, maybe. For the sake of more examples, because this book, as you mentioned, works based on the examples. Maybe let's look at the chapter one, where you consider the anti-racist politic of John Coetzee, the feminist politic of Cindy Sherman, the politic of Jeff Wall, and the cultural industry critic of Alejandro Iñárritu, as compelling, right, examples of art. And their works in a certain ways attain a level of plausibility to this material support, including commodity characteristics. Would you tell us how you, maybe it's a little big question, we can tackle each examples, but I'm curious if you can tell us more about different examples and how you can see this move from one medium to another works.
Yeah. So I have to think myself back to 2018 when I wrote that chapter, and 2019, or when I revised it and try to remember the logic. But I do remember it more or less. So again, we're dealing with three different media that have quite different relationships to the market, right? In other words, so one of them is Hollywood film, where there's a certain kind of almost brutally empirical insulation because, works of art are so big that there's no time for immediate feedback. It's not like a television show where they can just, adjust to market expectations right away. So they're all, so many of these movies are sort of big gambles or were. Then you have the novel, which actually has, a quite different relationship where there's not anywhere near the kind of, investment involved. And in Coetzee's case, not even clear that he was sort of interested in making any kind of major splash with his first book, Dusklands. Art photography. And Jeff Wall has a super interesting article, which I won't try to reproduce here, about the relationship of art photography to the market, and how, in a certain way, it is insulated from the market by being, designed, meant for a museum, meant for a very specialized sort of audience, but at the same time, only registers as mattering once it begins to have a market. So those are the four sort of instances that it tries to tie together. Really, the book is, or so the chapter is about the film and the art photography. But what ties them together is a kind of all three examples is a kind of lateralness, a kind of turning sideways of the entire apparatus, the ordinary apparatus of the medium is sort of turned sideways in its address to the reader or the beholder. So for example, in Kotseya, you know, ordinarily, you know, or at least one could say the sort of, you know, null instance of the novel, you have a story that's, you know, being told to you. In Dusklands, in the well, I can't remember the exact name of the novella, but the something's, you know, narrative of Jacobus Kotseya, Jacobus maybe Kotseya. You never get the story. You get three versions of the story, none of which, you know, hang together. But what you get then is a sort of struggle among these three different authors to sort of make their meaning stick. And so it, rather than the sort of, you know, story being sort of addressed to you, you see these three stories that are, you know, in a certain sense addressed to some narrator that you can't, audience that you can't even see. It's a fictional audience. You know, obviously you're the real empirical audience. I'm just gonna take a break and give you a chance to ask any questions about that, Kaveh, because I've been spinning that out for a while, but I can go on.
I'm sorry, this question was very much specific, and there are so many examples, like I'm still, you know, struggling to remember all of them. I think you mentioned that the Duskland, right? The Kutsias, but regarding maybe I can stay for one more question on Jeff Walls, because you brought an interesting aspect of art photography, this aspect that being counted as art itself, actually, it's the opening the door for also being subsumed in this market relationship or to get the market value. So this kind of dialectics, I'm curious, maybe you can tell us more about how this dialectic works, maybe specifically to the art photography.
Yeah, I think so. Tell me if I'm not getting your understanding your question right. So, you know, something again that Jeff Wall is super, you know, self-aware about. And he's talking about, I think, Cindy Sherman, when he says, you know, something different happened. There's a certain point when you could pick up, you know, you could get a Cindy Sherman picture, you know, for $50. You'd buy it from her, and it was like $50, right? At that point, there is no market, right? But the point is not that, like, it's ever going to, you know, reach a sort of general market where, like, they're just going to be, you know, selling like hotcakes. They have a market when they're understood to have artistic value. Right. So, you know, they are protected from the sort of from the general market by a restricted market of people who count as counting, by, you know, people like you and me, in some very minor way, museum directors, curators and so on, in a much more major way, you know, major art historians in a major way and so on and so forth, auction houses, valuations and so on and so forth. So, you know, it looks like market value, but market value actually only registers the fact that there's a prior aesthetic judgment that's being made outside of the market that then determines the market. So this market sort of registers that something is counting, and it's the only way that really register it in a society like ours. But nonetheless, it's not a directly market judgment. You know, Hollywood film is, you know, the success of a Hollywood film is measured in box office. And that's just, that's irreversible. You know, if Birdman, had sold no tickets, we would not be talking about it. And, you know, but you know, the point is it's designed to be an art film, but it's designed to be an art film that sells tickets. It's a very different sort of mode of distribution and circulation than does someone like Jürgen Leth, who's never a Danish director, who's never, you know, been interested and never needed to because of the way the Danish film industry is set up, never needed to sell a screenplay.
Yeah, Yuga Left was interesting for me specifically. This book's introducing for me, actually, honestly. And yeah, maybe I don't know. Do you want to talk a little more about him and why specifically his approach in comparison to other examples that given the book?
Yeah, well, so Kavi, have you seen The Perfect Man, Perfect Human? Well, it's available on YouTube. I'll recommend this for your audience. Just Google Jürgen Less, The Perfect Human, and you'll see what he's all about. It's a fantastic short little film. And I forget the name of the actor, but also just actors. But the male actor is they're both great, but he's spectacular. Yeah. So the film that I picked up as being relevant though to television was The Five Obstructions, which he did with what's his name? What's the other Danish director with the help me out here, Kaveh. I mean, I can look it up. Lars von Trier. So Lars von Trier, who's a big admirer of Less, but basically has an opposite approach. Lars von Trier is going for the wounding detail. He's going for a kind of affect, which is very the opposite of Jürgen Less's approach. And he wants to force Less to make a mistake, and he wants him to remake The Five Obstructions. He wants him to remake The Perfect Human five times. Each time according to a set of rules set by Leth himself, by von Trier himself. And the point is, you know, in a friendly rivalry way, sort of trying to trip him up and force him to produce a different kind of art. Von Trier, I mean, you know, I would say von Trier fails, but that's not exactly how it works. It's more that Leth, like, amazingly sort of succeeds in overcoming all these obstructions. But the key thing is that at a certain point, he says, make it a cartoon. And Les is like, I hate cartoons. Why would I ever do this? This is going to kill me. I want to quit. But then he decides to make it into a stylized, thriller, a 4-minute stylized thriller. So he tried to make the whole thriller, absorbed in these, 5 minutes and sort of produce all of the genre beats of the thriller, in the 5 minutes, in a sort of rotoscoped version. And it's fun, it's stylish, it's beautiful. It kind of amazingly does the thriller thing. You kind of have a thriller mood for 4 minutes. But it's not supposed to be, it's not doing the thriller, right? In other words, it's not selling tickets. It's not trying to sell tickets. It's not giving you any of the other things that you want out of the thriller. It's only 4 minutes long. It doesn't give you, any chase scenes. It doesn't give you explosions, any of the thrills and so on and so forth. What it is very clearly another version of The Perfect Human, where the whole point is the whole point of all of them is that's an oxymoron, that there's no such thing as a perfect human because there's no such thing as a human. It's not something that has a external definition that way. And so that becomes the point of the 4-minute thing. So the relationship that to television is that in television, you can't not do a genre. In other words, it's as though Lars von Trier, whatever you wanted to say, Lars von Trier is standing over your shoulder saying, make it a cartoon, make it a detective show, make it a soap opera, make it a sitcom. You know, the choices aren't many. Whatever you have to say, you have to make it one of those. And so, I don't think there are a ton of successful examples, but there are some examples of television shows that have managed to sort of, take that that sort of genre imperative and turn it into something else. In other words, make that go away as a determining instance. Instead, the frame is still there or the canvas is still there, but the history of easel painting does not become a determining instance when you're trying to decide what a work of art means. And so many times when you're watching, my wife is right now watching a, I don't remember the name of it, watching a hospital drama. And according to her, it's something that you can watch while you're exercising, because if you miss several beats, it doesn't matter, because you know how to fill in the beats. You know exactly what happened anyway. You know which characters are going to die of a brain aneurysm and which ones are going to pull through, and so on and so forth. The genre determines them. So my example is The Wire, which is hardly a, you know, that is the TV show that our sort of class fraction likes and things like it. But nonetheless, I mean, I think it succeeds in doing precisely that, in sort of making the cop show, rather, as a determining instance, disappear.
Yeah, maybe to tie to this up, what you mentioned in the book, you brought up the example of The Wire, which was intriguing, specifically, you know, regarding to what you call the excessiveness of the genre figure of these detective shows. It was very much interesting, the excessiveness of this genre. How would you define this excessiveness, like specifically in
the... Yeah. So, you know, I think it is true. I mean, we were watching, I mean, it doesn't really matter. My wife and I are watching Perry Mason, the new Perry Mason, which isn't that great. The figure of the detective, or, you know, in that case, a lawyer, but the detective figure, as you know, brooding, monomaniacal, you know, absolutely, you know, monomaniacally sort of devoted to, like, you know, a certain kind of investigation or a certain investigation, is built in. And my understanding of that is that has totally to do with the history of the genre and its necessity for pushing aside other genres. In other words, not being soap opera, not being sitcom, not being any of the other television genres, requiring a kind of pushing aside these other genres. And it's actually funny, as I was doing research for the book, I was looking at old cop shows and just amazed at how many times the main policeman or the main cop, the sergeant or detective or whatever, is served divorce papers in the first episode. And what's the point of that? The point is, like, yes, he's a person or she, but in the Danish versions, she, but in the American ones I was looking back to for historical research, he, you know, served divorce. Yes, they have a life. They have, you know, they're a human being. They're like a quote unquote well-rounded character. However, they're too obsessed. They can't have a personal life. And therefore it closes in and sort of, seals off the genre from all the other genres. And, you know, that has become such a sort of aspect of the genre that you can't really have Luther, The Killing, like all of these, you know, all of the sort of contemporary examples have the sort of driven excessive character. So the genius part, I thought, of The Wire was to turn that into a sort of Antigone figure, where the obsession is going to cause just, like, it's not going to solve cases. It's just going to cause damage. It's just gonna, you know, it's just gonna discover things, and, you know, it's not the only version. The Killing, the Danish show, did the same thing with its character, Detective Lund, was it? Can't remember her name. To turn that figure into a kind of figure of destruction, whose commitment to a certain kind of truth, or just to the truth, is going to end up sort of blowing up everything else. And of course, in The Wire, that also leads to a whole other set of, you know, tragic conflicts, you know, conflicting commitments, you know, that sort of can't play out. And as they do play out, as they, you know, do play out because they, you know, are empirically in conflict and actual human beings, are just going to play out by, like, tragedy, you know, made by causing disasters. So, you know, but... Maybe I've answered your question, but the obsessive figure is like a very old genre figure that comes from TV as a medium, The Killing, the Danish one, maybe the American one too, but the Danish one, and The Wire, you know, really take that and turn it into something else, sort of make the sort of arbitrariness of that figure disappear.
You have this interesting phrase expression, a condition of possibility for this mode of figuration. This was like interesting way that you put this.
I'm interrupting, but just like, in other words, condition of possibility and limit are the same thing, right? Just with a different kind of, with a kind of mastery of it, or a kind of a supersession of it. In other words, the canvas is a problem unless you produce a successful one, and then it's not a problem. The sort of genre determinants are a problem unless you find something to do with them and turn them into something else, in which case they're not problems, they're, you know, conditions of possibility. It's like conditions of possibility and limit are sort of the same thing, under a different aspect.
So how then do we understand this in relation to self-legislative aspect of this autonomy? How we do this transition?
Yeah, right. So this is, there's a lot of ways to think about this. But this is the general instance, or this is the general, this is the, like, art, in this sense, art is just an instance of the general problem of meaning or action as such, because any action we take is in many, many ways, in sort of the preponderance of ways, not ours. It takes place in a situation which we didn't invent, in a language we didn't invent, under physical conditions we didn't invent, historical conditions we didn't invent, conventions we didn't invent, personal limitations we didn't, the list literally, when I say it goes on forever, just literally, it could go on forever. So what does intention even mean? Like, does that have any sort of sense? So you can see how this relates to the work of art, right? In the sense that, like, the determinations that aren't the work of art are, again, infinite. So the question is, how does one register an intention? How does one make something happen under these circumstances? And what I'm trying to say is, like, that's actually an extremely common. In other words, it's actually not that big of a problem. In other words, it's what we call intention all the time. In other words, dance, for example, doesn't take place in the absence of gravity. It uses gravity. It turns gravity from a limit into a condition of possibility. Easel painting takes the two dimensions of the canvas and turns it from a limit into a condition of possibility. In fact, action in general requires, again, we don't think about it this way. If we did, we'd go crazy thinking about all the determinations. But what we do when we do things is to turn limitations to account. Yeah. Does that help? Or is that?
I think so. These are very much like a constellation of ideas, and very much I'm always amused by, the extent in which, they can be taught. And also, I consider, you mentioned this is not just about art, but about this humans and about actions, and also maybe I'm thinking, I don't know, maybe not in close in relation about the rule following in some extent. I think the same problems appears there too.
For sure. And genre is actually a good way of thinking about that distinction. I've had a lot of conversations since the book came out with people who are working in genre or who are taking genre seriously. And many of them always want to revert to the question of the genre as rules. And there's no question that in a certain sense, a genre is a set of rules, right? Otherwise it ends up not being recognizable as a genre. The point I would want to make is that when a artwork, takes up a genre in order to sort of turn it into its own conditions of possibility, what counts as the genre, right, is what counts for that work as the genre, right? In other words, there are lots of, you know, there are lots of things in the detective or in the cop show genre that aren't in The Wire, right? It makes itself recognizable as a version of the cop show by invoking certain aspects of the genre. And that's true of any sort of attempt to sort of, you know, take up a genre. I mean, it's even true with Flaubert taking up realism in Sentimental Education. You know, there are aspects of the realist novel that aren't there if you took it as a list of rules, but you can tell very clearly that he's like trying to do something with the genre of the realist novel because he tells you he is in the novel, right? So, you know, it is not following a set of rules. In other words, yes, there is some kind of infinitely long list of genre conventions, but the ones that count are the ones that that the artwork itself sort of, you know, tells you count, makes them count.
Yeah, that's why you use family resemblance in this sense. They may make these exactly these sets of team that resembles their affinities, but of course with their own distinction. I'm curious about the politics of autonomy. You touch on this in the book, and there are phrases, I mean, there are the passages, the pointing, for example, about how the arts can contribute to quote, the project of constructing a world without hunger and without police. Basically, you're bringing up the two ways in which capitalism can enforce exploitation. So, but you see these moments in this art, you can resist. Maybe this is temporarily. I'm curious. Maybe you can tell us more about this.
Yeah,
politics.
Yeah. So this is definitely the least liked part about the book. I mean, not by me. I still think it's fine. But yeah. So depending on who you are, there are different ways for that my line to be sort of unpalatable. You know, one is, you know, I insist that the work of art doesn't have any levers. In other words, like, I belong to a union. A union has a lever. The lever is the strike. You know, it can force people who disagree with you to do what you want to do. That's political power. And, you know, voting is not as powerful as a strike, but it also is a way to force people to do what you want them to do, and so on and so forth. So there are, you know, organized, you know, longstanding institutions have a certain kind of power that artworks, they just don't have that leverage. You know, it's sort of customary to go to sort of, you know, good examples and say, you know, what about this? What about that? That are sort of nice, comfortable liberal examples. But look at something like The Fountainhead, right? Yeah, on the one hand, like, you know, every libertarian member of Congress claims to have read The Fountainhead and it's changed his or her life. On the other hand, those are people who already weren't going to be like libertarian assholes in the first place. You know, I read The Fountainhead at the same time as they did in high school. You know, and I sort of, you know, whatever. The point is, like, when you're confronted with a work of art, you're free. You know, you're convinced by it or not. You find it compelling or you don't. Now, the thing is, though, that's, you know, so when I say it's powerless, I just mean it doesn't have any levers the way a strike or a vote or a protest or, you know, any number of things might actually have levers. But, you know, I also claim, and this is like another version that the line is unpopular, or not unpopular, but meets with resistance, which is good, is that I claim that, or entailed in all what I'm saying, is that artworks have something to say, and that what they have to say is made compelling or not by how well they do the thing they do, how well they convince you that they have something to say, and that something meets with a kind of very difficult to quantify agreement from your sort of mode of experience being a human in the same world or even a different world than that in which the work of art takes place. And so you can be convinced by a work of art, Just like you can be convinced by an argument that that unions are a good idea. So, in other words, no, when I say that works of art have no power, I mean in that particular sense, like of actually sort of holding on, you know, having some kind of contact with an actual lever of power. But they can convince you, that's for sure.
Yeah, to some extent, I don't know, you might not be, I don't know if you are agree, but very much I'm thinking along the line of structure of feeling to some extent. So this convincibility, right? Like, created this more, perhaps this collective, not a clear idea, but the sense how to go. Which still remains in the culture, but I think in terms of, for example, if unionization, so this I mean, there can be a sort of culture that helping to, you know, build on, for example, those institutions that perhaps would, at the end of the road, with help for holding the power and, you know, exerting the power through these institutions. Anyhow, this is a really hard question. I really encounter the same idea about, like, how, like, art matters, to what extent, and specifically during the time of crisis. And I think if we look back also to the history of art, it seems that very much the same crisis as it's appeared, for example, about avant-garde, right? I think you mentioned this in the book too, like the reaction about this problem and how they wanted to abandon the category of art because they saw that there's a crisis. Yeah, maybe you want to...
Yeah, so that's a super complicated... as you say, it's a hard question because it's also, you know, has to be thought about super historically. And I think that's a lot of the, the problems or paradoxes or contradictions we get to when we start thinking about the avant-garde in terms of our contemporary situation. Because on my view, the avant-garde only makes sense. You know, the sort of, you know, the whole impetus to make art life, to make art over into life, which is a kind of critique, obviously, of bourgeois institutions, only makes sense on the understanding that the life that you're being integrated to is something else. It's a utopian, utopian mode of thinking, whether it's explicitly linked to politics or not. So for example, you know, in the Brazilian instance, in the 60s, you know, that sort of Brazilian avant-gardism was completely committed to, like, a revolutionary program in which the art that would be to which, or, you know, the life with which art would be made one. In other words, the art that would no longer be art. It's not going to be like one with this life. It's going to be one with, you know, this post-revolutionary utopian life. It's going to be totally different. And, you know, I'm certainly not saying that there will never be a post to capitalism. And I'm also saying that, though, if there is, we won't need art. You know, obviously we'll still have culture, we'll have entertainment, we'll have, you know, all kinds of things. But art would not necessarily be on the agenda. So in that sense, I would agree with the avant-gardists. But what I disagree with it is when the avant-garde or some version of the avant-garde is understood to be radical today, you know, divorced from a plausible revolutionary program, as though making art life is somehow still a radical program, where it's not. In other words, making art life is just making it into more commodities, making it into more capitalism. You know, in fact, you know, erasing the distinction between art and life, you know, the instance of it that tends to dominate is versions of making art into a commodity, or into a spectacle, which ends up being a commodity, into a statement, which ends up being like a political statement, which ends up being a purchasable point of identification. As again, we tend to think of the liberal ones, but you know, Ayn Rand does perfectly well here. The market for Ayn Rand is people who already want to believe Ayn Rand. And so on and so forth. Yeah. Is that
begin to answer?
It's a super historical question. So, you know, the avant-garde is like genuinely a left phenomenon sometimes. sometimes it's not. It depends on what the political program you know that it sort of integrates with, and whether that integration makes any sense.
Yeah, I specifically in terms of like examples of us as you're specifically talking to this problem, I was thinking about the project of neo-avant-garde as the, you know, appropriating some of this avant-garde, you know, unfinished project of avant-garde and bringing into the new context, historical context, and at the end, the failure of that project perhaps very much shows that. I was thinking about this region. Yeah, very very complex. I always baffled with the. Maybe as a final question, specifically, I would like to know if there will be any book in the near future, and when we can expect it to be released.
Oh, I don't know. There. I'm working on a couple of books. I'm working on one. You heard me talk a minute ago about Brazil. I'm sort of interested in that period, in the moment when the Brazilian high modernism of its moment becomes avant-garde. So around 1964. When all of these, and particularly 1968, it's a complicated situation, but where all of these neo-concretists, suddenly confronted with what's happening politically, realize that they want to be doing something else, but it ends up working out in all kinds of different ways for these different artists. So I'm writing a book on that, and I'm slowly. Trying to do something on Mahler. I'm not sure it's going to end up being a book, but again, it may be a little bit too complicated to try to figure out what I'm trying to say in that book right now. But Mahler is actually struggling with both sort of the major version of this. In other words, what does materiality have to do with art? Or rather, it has everything to do with music. What does that mean for the art part of it? And he's dealing with the market version. We haven't really talked about music, but he's the first superstar conductor. He's deeply involved in the contemporary, in what is then the art the music market. Anyway, that's very inchoate, but that's what I'm working on. And I have no idea what I'm going to do. None at all.
I'm happy that you brought up the music, because I probably that's my fault. I skipped chapter 3, because in chapter 3 you brought up the music very much bossa nova and you look at the pop also. Also, the new version, I think you covered like a Kurt Weill, Caetano Veloso, and the White Strip. So this is in a wide range of the music. I'm not quite familiar. I know Bossa Nova, but I haven't listened to White Strip, honestly. Anyhow, I don't know. Do you want to have the chapter and the music?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, Kurt Weill, Caetano Veloso, and the White Stripes have generically almost nothing in common, except that they are all at that moment writing, you know, popular forms of one sort or another. But they're all confronting the problem of the market. What was interesting to me in writing that chapter is that there are three different historical moments when the relationship to the market is quite different, but they end up producing similar. Strategies for overcoming that sort of relationship to the market, but the strategies look and sound very different. They end up being sort of the same, almost like you might say, you know, theoretically or something. And that is, they all end up using, they all end up becoming like citational. Kurt Weill obviously writing with Brecht at a moment when they're, you know, when art music on Vile's account is making all kinds of progress, progress internal to a very small restricted field and not actually making any kind of headway outside of that. Kurt Vile wants to write for a larger audience. Writing for a larger audience means writing for the market. In particular, musical theater, Brecht is obviously interested in producing a certain kind of politics, but again, not just for a small group, but for, in a certain sense, everyone, for a large market. So they both risk the market, but they take it, you know, as a deliberate risk to be taken. Caetano Veloso in the post 64 Brazil is composing in the midst, who, by the way, is a little known fact. Caetano Veloso started off writing, his very first commission was for a Brecht play, which is like a crazy fact if you know what Caetano sounds like. But anyway, I'll let that go. People might agree with that or disagree with it. But seeing a tremendous expansion of the cultural market at a time when the memory of a popular art form is recent, right? In other words, you know, bossa nova, you know, it was quote unquote popular, but it was also an erudite form, it was a bourgeois form, but it managed to sort of, you know, turn a set of protocols which came from Chopin and came from art poetry and turn them into, you know, a worldwide sort of phenomenon that nonetheless didn't give up on its artistic ambitions. And the whole problematic for Caetano, and this is very explicit in his, you know, writings at the time, he's always written, you know, prose along with music, is that he lived through its disappearance. So the sort of, you know, the problem of the art market for Caetano is like not exactly new, but it's visible as like unbelievably clear. He sees it unbelievably clearly. You know, I don't know if he'd read Adorno at the time, but comes up with very Adornian formulations of seemingly sui generis, just from sort of observing the relationship of art to the emergent market. And then, you know, for the White Stripes, I mean, it's a more or less 21st century phenomenon. There's no memory of a pre-market pop or pre-market rock. You know, there's a fantasy of it in punk, but that was a fantasy. It was as much a commodity as any other rock. Yeah. So in these three moments, there's a sort of, you know, three very different relationships to the market, but nonetheless, the sort of technique they all use is citationality. In other words, what they want to say, they end up saying by citing other forms and other quoting other forms and other genres, but turning them into and making them speak to each other in a way that sort of is determinate. And so you can, they're not just sort of pastiches where, oh, there's a nice version of, you know, hasn't Caetano done a nice version of a Portuguese fado? But rather, what is he trying to, you ask the question, why this genre here? Why is this album this collection of genres and not some other collection of genres? And once you start, you know, asking those why questions, you're right back to the question of the work of art. In other words, why is it there? You don't know why it's there. There's no rule for it. You have to look at the work of art itself. It will tell you, or it won't. But your job is to ask that question why, and try to answer the question why this rather than something else.
Mm-hmm. Then how then this in terms of the connection about this citation, which is quite interesting. I was thinking about Tropicália. How then you see Tropicália would in relation to this tree that we discussed, how do you see the Tropicália's the genre can be defined? Specifically, Tropicália very much also the historical moment that it came is very much closer to the coup, right? It's also the yeah, maybe we can touch on the Tropicália because I'm really interested in the Tropicália, especially in relation to the art, Brazilian art. And
yeah, so two things. One is Tropicália, as you know, was first an artwork by Elio Chisica. And it was actually, I mean, not a very compelling version of it, but there was a version of it in Chicago not too long ago when there was a Ojisika traveling exhibition. It's thoroughly citational. In other words, you know, the whole way that that work of art works is like producing different sort of class structures and different class positions and different sort of cliches and so on and so forth. Class positions and cliches, and putting them in, juxtaposing with each other and turning them into a set of contradictions. And, you know, just to put it, you know, maybe too quickly, that's what Tropicália does too. And Tropicália, the musical movement, which doesn't really last very long, is, but also citational. In other words, turning avant-garde recording techniques, but turning them onto, you know, a ridiculously insipid melody that has, you know, that ends, for example, with the church cadence, with a 5-1 or 4-1 rather church cadence. So, you know, the church cadence, you're meant to hear it as a church cadence, the sort of, you know, elements of circus music, you're supposed to hear as elements of circus music. The kind of, you know, avant-garde recording techniques, you're supposed to hear as those avant-garde recording techniques. And all these things are sort of understood as being in tension with each other. And that's then what has to be read. You know, in other words, it's probably more than I can do right now, but Roberto Schwartz does it very well in his, you know, in his a long essay on that period. You know, how these juxtapositions then are meant to be read, not exactly as allegories, but as sort of instances of contradictions that are national and historical in scope.
Yeah, I would say thank you, Nick, for coming on to the podcast. It was a great pleasure to talking to you.
Absolutely, it's been a pleasure.